content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Walter Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the November 2025 issue. We begin in the Explore department with House Tours, five residents across the state that offer an inside look at history and how society has evolved, by Sydney Brainerd. Stepping inside a historic home can offer an intimate perspective on what kinds of lives its former inhabitants lived. To be able to step back in time and see something that's been preserved since, say, the 1700s, gives one a sense of permanence, a sense of continuity, says Vanna O'Neill, president of the Cupola House Association in Edenton. North Carolina has several grand homes across the state that are worth visiting for their architectural significance and the ways they illustrate our society's evolution since the colonial era. The next time you want to explore more of North Carolina, consider a road trip to visit one of these five historic homes. Tryon Palace. As the state's first capital, New Bern is a worthwhile destination for anyone who enjoys history. The Tryon Palace and grounds, located at the waterfront edge of downtown, immerse you instantly into the colonial era. After construction was completed in 1770, the Georgian-style mansion served as the home of North Carolina's governor at the time, William Tryon. His family, and, as highlighted by the palace's Life on the Lesser Stairs tour, a sizable crew of servants and enslaved workers. The current palace is largely a recreation of the original due to a fire that destroyed the main building in 1798, but was reconstructed on the original foundations using the original architectural plans. Tours of the palace, led by costumed tour guides, take you through the opulent residence, with its walls of intricate, colorful molding and large collection of antique, period-accurate furniture pulled straight from Tryon's meticulously cataloged inventory. The tour also takes you through the kitchen office, a more modest building with brick floors and a massive fireplace, where servants prepared meals for the family. During the tour, you can see historical actors cooking in the kitchen, like servants would have centuries ago. On your own, you can explore the stable office, complete with several horse stalls and a harness room in its original structure from the 1770s, as well as the vast palace gardens on the property. After your visit, you can continue to explore the historic homes and buildings near the palace, like the 1830s Dixon House or the New Bern Academy Museum. Don't forget to grab a bite to eat in downtown New Bern, either. If you've got kids in tow, the Cow Cafe on Middle Street is always a crowd pleaser with its homemade ice cream and fresh pies. Or Corner's Folly. Design addicts will either love or loathe the architectural anomaly that is Kerner's Folly in Kernersville. Construction began in 1878 on this Victorian-era home, which served as a studio and design portfolio, as well as a home for interior designer Jules Gilmer Kerner. Kerner was an eccentric figure, regularly renovating his house to accommodate all his new ideas, even after he married and had a family. At the time of his death in 1924, his daughter discovered that Kerner had even had future renovation plans for the house. The house's architectural styles range from Gothic to Colonial, New Classical to Baroque. Colors, textiles, furnishings, and decor vary widely throughout the house. Today, the home is open to be explored, even as it continues to be preserved and restored. Kerner's Folly offers both guided and self-guided tours, so you can choose your own pace. Follow up your tour with a stop at the Prescott just down the road for wine and dinner made with local ingredients. The Duke Homestead State Historic Site and Tobacco Museum, just a short trip from Raleigh, tucked away in the forest lies the storied Duke Homestead, a simple frame house built in 1852 by Washington Duke. Within a few decades, the Duke family would control the tobacco industry and later help create what is now Duke University. The site of the homestead, along with the accompanying tobacco museum, tells the story of Washington Duke and his family, along with the two enslaved workers who lived on the property. It traces the Dukes from their earliest beginnings as farmers to the start of their tobacco empire, when they began to outgrow the factories and farm on the property. The site offers 45-minute guided tours of the homestead, which includes the house, farm, and factory buildings, as well as self-guided option of just the visitor center and museum, as the historic building interiors are only accessible with a guide. After your visit, take a stroll around Duke University's sprawling campus, where you'll spot a statue of Washington Duke reclining in a bronze chair at the entrance to the East Campus. The Cupola House, only steps from the shores of Edenton Bay, sits the colonial-era Cupola House and its lush gardens. As North Carolina's second oldest town, Edenton is chock-full of history. During the 18th and early 19th centuries, it was a prominent port city and part of the Maritime Underground Railroad. The Cupola House, built in 1758 by a land agent named Francis Corbin, was constructed with a blend of Jacobean, colonial, and Georgian architectural styles, gets its name from the large cupola that sits atop the roof. The Cupola House provides guided tours, while the gardens are free to explore between 9 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. daily. Stop by the Herringbone on the Waterfront for dinner with a view, or the nearby Inner Banks Inn provides a charming historic bed and breakfast experience. And lastly, the Biltmore. You can't talk about grand historical North Carolina homes without mentioning the Biltmore Estate. Built by George Vanderbilt as a country retreat, the 175,000 square foot French Renaissance Revival style home was built primarily from limestone sourced from Indiana. Aside from the house, the estate contains large gardens, a winery, an inn, a hotel, cottages, a farmyard, and a shopping area. While the Biltmore is especially popular around the holidays for its elaborate Christmas decor, the warmer seasons offer much to see as well, including abundant blooms like hydrangeas, abelias, magnolias, and a variety of tropical plants, as well as lovely weather for wine tasting and visiting the farmyard. For the full Biltmore experience, spend the night at one of the many accommodations on the property, or head out to explore Asheville's renowned food scene. This article was edited for Time. Next, from the noted department, The Pirate Invasion, A Romp Through Coastal History, by C.C. Parker. On August 26, 1747, a ship of Spanish privateers attacked North Carolina's coastal town of Beaufort. The colonists had to rely on themselves against the foreign invaders, and after days under siege, they drove the pirates away. The pirates never returned. Now each year, the colonists' victory is celebrated and reenacted at Beaufort's two-day pirate invasion event. The gathering has grown from a locals-only, quote, day of living history in 1960 to a weekend of pirate-themed activities attended by thousands of people. From sword fighting and puppetry to campfire cooking and blacksmithing, the event draws such a large crowd that residents jokingly call it the tourist invasion. I'd always wanted to experience the invasion for myself. And finally, last year, I made a plan. I enlisted my history buff 23-year-old daughter, Bailey, as my sidekick to, quote, sail through time to 1747, end quote, the pirate invasion tagline. Her only stipulation was that we both dress in period costume. Our pirate weekend kicked off with an evening dinner cruise aboard Beaufort's Crystal Coast Lady, a locally based 120-passenger yacht. There, according to the schedule, pirates would enjoy a barbecue buffet and revelry. The deckhands saluted us as we walked up the gangplank. Singing and plucky guitar music streamed from inside the boat. Inside, a rollicking live pirate band, the Motley Tones, was playing, and costumed partygoers of all ages were line dancing. Guests balancing rum punch in plastic tumblers maneuvered through the crowd. As the boat backed away from the dock and swung into Taylor's Creek, a lady in a red and black velvet ball gown welcomed the crowd and thanked the sponsors. I had taken great care in selecting our dinner seats, so was surprised to find 16 people seated at our reserved 8-person table. Knowing that mistakes happen, I addressed the large, bearded man dressed in a cloak and breeches with a saber strapped across his chest, sitting at the head of the table, who appeared to be the leader. Giving him my biggest smile, I showed him my tickets. "There's been a mistake," I say. "Those two seats at the end of the table belong to us." All conversation at the table stopped. He rolled his eyes, placed his hands onto the table, and heaved himself up. "You can sit in those empty seats," he said, pointing to a table across the room. Luck was on our side, however. At our reassigned table, we sat with Pegleg, a man who, we learned, is a fixture at every pirate invasion. He sat silently at the end of the table for most of dinner, until the rum punch had flowed and the pirate songs became a bit more bawdy. Soon enough, he was singing along, popping his leg into the air in time to the music, and we joined in. Saturday's festivities began at 11 a.m., which was fine by me. Like these pirates, I'm not an early riser. In keeping with my daughter's request, I had ordered full-body costumes on Amazon. Unfortunately, I didn't realize I'd actually ordered 2 British redcoat costumes until I unpacked them the day of the invasion. Not quite the right costumes, wrong enemies, and off by a few decades, but at least they showed effort. We zipped ourselves into our polyester pantsuits, donned our tri-cornered hats, and set off. The day was bright and clear, perfect for a skirmish. Parking our golf cart in a metered spot, we found seats along the dock. Around us, Front Street was bustling, with throngs of pirates, scads of colonial-garbed people, and curious onlookers in plainclothes. Bailey and I, in our matching red coat outfits, fit right in. The colonial encampment where the reenactment takes place is set up along the span of the Graydon Paul Park, downtown on the waterfront. Though partitioned off from the public, we could see the various tents, a communal kitchen, a fire pit, laundry lines, and a tarot card reader within the camp. The crowd was in high spirits as we watched the Spanish pirate boat approach the encampment. We heard shouting and cannons being fired. There was a heated exchange between the pirates on the boat and the colonists on land. The Spanish ship docked and Spaniards began marching onto land. There was a skirmish with swords and guns flailing, and then the Spanish flag went up the flagpole, the signal for intermission. The crowd dispersed for lunch, and Bailey and I headed to Wild Will's root beer stand, where we splurged on the signature Pirate Invasion root beer steins, then grabbed a quick lunch of fish and chips at Queen Anne's Revenge restaurant on the waterfront. Afterwards, meandering through the colonial demonstration area, we stopped at two different ironsmith tents, where they were making fire pokers and other tools for campfire cooking. Trying to stay on invasion schedule, we hustled 500 feet from the waterfront to the Beaufort Historical Society property for the pirate trial at the old jail. We didn't find the pirate trial, but there was live music on the porch, a freestanding puppet show, and an arts and crafts area. We took a moment to walk through Mattie Davis King Art Gallery on the Historical Society property. Back to the docks, in the second act, there was another skirmish, and the pirates were defeated. The program gave way to sword fighting demonstrations. With the programming over for the day, the final stop was the Backstreet Pub, a much-loved watering hole for innumerable boat crews, college students, pirates, and folks just looking for a good time for the past 100 years. The next morning, a few of the Carrot Island wild ponies appeared just across the creek, and we opted to stay home to enjoy the view. Sitting out on our porch, we enjoyed the shouts from the skirmish and cannon fire. When the trumpet sounded and the crowd cheered in honor of the colonists' perseverance, we raised our root beer steins, this time filled with coffee, to their victory. Upstairs in my closet, our costumes still hang in hopes Bailey is willing to come with me again next year. This article was edited for Time. Next, from the Nature Department, bucks and does. A conservation success, white-tailed deer can be both destructive and a delight, by Mike Dunn. My introduction to white-tailed deer came as a young teen going hunting with my father in Virginia. Though Dad was an excellent hunter, I never killed a deer, perhaps because I just couldn't bring myself to pull the trigger. But now I understand the need for hunting as a means of deer population management. When colonists first arrived, white-tailed deer were quite common, a staple of Native American diet and clothing needs. But large-scale changes in the landscape soon followed. Populations in North Carolina dwindled to around 10,000 deer in the entire state in the early 1900s, a mere 1% of what they may have been in pre-colonial times. Alarmed by this decline, laws were passed and hunting regulations enacted to try to preserve the herds. That effort became a huge conservation success story, as the population of deer in the state is now estimated at about 1 million. I've developed an ambivalent relationship with local deer herd. I enjoy seeing them in the woods and catching their behaviors on the trail cameras, but I've seen their impact on the forest and on our yard. A couple of years after moving in, I erected a 7-foot-tall plastic mesh deer fence surrounding about an acre around the house. That gave the deer access to our remaining 13 acres, so I figured it was a fair deal. Our wildflowers and shrubs prospered within the fence with only an occasional breach, but last year, while we were on an extended vacation, a tree fell across the fence. When we returned, it looked like someone had used a weed eater on all of our gardens. It was heartbreaking, but they eventually grew back. Vegetation on the other 13 acres has not fared as well. Wildflowers that were scattered across the property in the mid-1990s disappeared within a decade. Deer, when overpopulated, can create a highly diminished forest. When a large tree falls in our woods now, there are no saplings to replace it. Please don't misunderstand me. I am glad deer are on our property. Deer are beautiful and exhibit lots of fascinating behaviors. The change in fur color twice each year is particularly striking as they shed their summer reddish-brown coat to the better winter camouflage of gray-brown fur. The winter coat provides greater insulation due to its long hollow guard hairs, which trap air to create an insulating layer, and dense underfur. Mating season for deer, called the rut, in our area peaks in November. As days begin to shorten, the males, bucks, produce more testosterone, leading to more aggressive behavior as they seek out receptive females, called does. Deer have their own brand of social media. Bucks will rub the bark off saplings, especially aromatic species like red cedar and sassafras, leaving behind a visual cue of their presence. They also deposit scent on the trees from glands located on the forehead and near the eyes. All this to impress the ladies and claim their turf. After the rut, similar-sized males will often form small bachelor herds and get along as if nothing had happened a few weeks earlier. Their testosterone levels drop, activating specialized cells called osteoclasts. These weaken the connection of the antlers, which will eventually drop off, usually in February or early March. They soon start growing their next set of antlers in preparation for another year of the rut. The growing antlers are covered in a blood-rich membrane known as velvet. During the first few months of growth, the velvet-covered antlers grow rapidly, often more than a quarter of an inch per day, making antler the fastest-growing bone tissue in the mammal world. Come late summer or early fall, bucks start rubbing off the velvet until the hardened white antlers are uncovered. Female deer give birth to one or two fawns in late spring. The young are reddish-brown with white spots that help camouflage them in the dappled sunlight of the forest. They have almost no scent and will lay still while their mother goes off to feed. If you find one, it's best to leave it alone, as its mother will soon return to nurse it. Deer feed on a variety of plants, as many gardeners painfully know, but one of their favorite foods are acorns. My trail camera videos show them loudly crunching each acorn, dropping out broken pieces of shell, and then searching for the next nutty morsel. One other behavior captured on our trail cameras surprised me. Deer can be very playful, and not just the fawns. They seem to particularly like to play in puddles and creeks. We have recorded deer getting into the water, looking around, then scooting backwards, pawing at the water, even sticking their faces in it. Then they often contort their body and leap in the air, twisting around and doing a mad dash before pausing and repeating. This can go on for several minutes, often with another deer joining in the fun. Who knew? This article was edited for Time. From the EndNote Storm Warning, Alluvial Decoder is a unique installation along the Greenway that drives home the dangers of flooding by Anne-Monique Clark. You might have noticed it on a jog or bike ride along the Crabtree Creek Trail, a series of squares in primary colors that resemble maritime flags. But if you slow down, they start to reveal letters, then familiar names, like Agnes, Matthew, and Floyd. Each of these storms or hurricanes caused major flooding in this area near the intersections of Glenwood Avenue and Ridge Road, just south of Crabtree Valley Mall. Called Alluvial Decoder, the installation is by A Gang of Three, a group of artists that includes William Dodge, Lincoln Hancock, and a rotating cast of collaborators. It was created in response to a call from the city of Raleigh to create an educational display to teach passersby about the floodplain. In addition to the mural, the installation includes striped poles that jut from a meadow along the embankment, each a marker of the heights this creek has reached in the past. Now, when the creek floods, these markers are visible above the surface, a reminder of how much higher the water could be. The team used their backgrounds in art, design, and architecture to create this site-specific piece. In addition to greenway traffic, part of the installation can be seen from the road. Nearly 60,000 cars drive by this site every day, so we wanted to create some breadcrumbs, some visual interest from the road to engage those folks as well, says Dodge. The painting itself was done by Raleigh muralist Luke Buchanan. He and Dodge met at the funeral of a mutual friend, Jackson Griffin, who drowned in floodwaters after Hurricane Fran. For us, it was more than a mural. Luke finished it on the 25th anniversary of Jackson's death, says Dodge. Hancock notes that the completion of the project also marked 50 years after that area was developed. Now we know what problems are caused when the land is paved, says Hancock. In designing the poles, it became clear that the worst floods happened just after the area was developed, before Raleigh's stormwater team worked on remediation efforts up and downstream. But as a gang of three was getting ready to install the markers, another significant flood happened, and they had to decide whether they were going to add another marker. It was a reminder of just how often these things happen, says Dodge. This article was originally printed in the August 2025 Walter Magazine, and today was edited for Time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.